supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In the family, when I was 14 years old, I confided to my sister that I'd started smoking cigarettes and begged her not to tell my parents. She was my confidant, and she protected me from my parents. 30 years later, I was a quadriplegic and divorced father of two teenagers, but our roles were the same. It was wonderful for both of us, but sometimes sibling roles can become a nightmare as we age. Consider you were the responsible child, and now you're the responsible adult sibling. Suddenly, you find yourself taking care of your aging parents' needs alone. As we grow, these roles can be like shackles as we find ourselves acting in ways we don't like whenever we're with our siblings. Well, how does it happen? How can we avoid it? And how can we evolve as siblings? On today's show, we'll be listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on adult sibling relationships. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Our guests were Drs. B. Janet Hibbs, Portia Hunt, and Marjorie Levitt. Hibbs is the co-director of the Center for Contextual Therapy Associates in Philadelphia. Hunt is professor of counseling at Temple University in Philadelphia, and Levitt is the co-author of Sibling Revelry, 8 Steps to Successful Adult Relationships. Marge, let's start with you. Every child comes to the family with its own temperament. It's got nothing to do with environment, and that alone can have great impact on sibling relationships. Is there anything parents can do to mitigate that?
I would think the most important thing a parent could do initially is to recognize and acknowledge the impact of temperament inside the family and from child to child. I think that can often be difficult because as we emerge with a temperament, we also emerge into an environment where there are particular expectations, a particular history, and the collision of all those factors, I think, can be sometimes uncomfortable.
There's another factor, and that's birth order. The more I read about birth order, the more confusing it is. It's really mixed. Let me turn to you, Portia. What's the deal here?
It's funny because some of the birth order has to do with whether or not you're in close age with your siblings. And the way it goes is if there's a big separation, then you have sets of children. If you're close together and the same sex, that can create all kinds of interesting competition between the older and younger sibling. So the birth order does have a lot to do with how you get positioned in the family and then some of the ways that parents project stuff onto you by virtue of being the youngest or oldest or middle child.
So now that we're talking about parents, B, let me turn to you. Some parents are rigid and strict. Some parents are flexible. Some parents understand temperament. Some parents live their lives to have their children come out a certain way. And of course, there's the marriage,
right,
too.
Yep.
So how do we begin to ferret out what family dynamics affect children and how?
I think that the, first of all, for parents to be fair to their children, they really do have to recognize how their children are very different from them, and also how their expectations for a particular child may not be fair and a child may not be able to meet it. And that's a very critical issue because children from a very, very young age, research has shown us, and you can see it by observation, try extremely hard to meet parental expectations. And so whether a child can meet those expectations and then whether those expectations are fair or unfair really shapes sibling relationships because siblings, you're too young as a child to really know whether your parents' expectations were fair or unfair. then there's some children who can meet them, some siblings who can't meet them, and that actually shapes sibling relationships because siblings really respond to each other based on whether they think they're being nice to their parents or they're being a troublemaker to their parents.
Marge, I want to talk about the rivalries that, I mean, this is your expertise that gets set up between children. Is rivalry inevitable, and is it always bad?
Well, I don't think rivalry is bad, and I don't know if it's inevitable. It would seem to me that given how we, for the most part, design families, it would kind of be inevitable. And I think when you look at children developmentally, it's inevitable that an older child will be able to do things that a younger child can't do, and the younger kids want to. I mean, I vividly remember to this day being 3 and my sister coming home from first grade. She's 3 years older than me and going, nah, I can read and you can't, which was true. And I can remember being devastated. That's rivalry. And you can bet that I set about learning how to read very quickly.
So that's my point.
Yeah.
Rivalry can be a good thing.
It yeah.
can give us some incentive.
Well, it connects with what you're saying about temperament. I think some children thrive in that environment and others are crushed.
You suggested that siblings need to, I want to get your language, unload the myths of their mm-hmm. shared past. Is the fact that they shared a past a myth?
I wish my brother was here. He would say yes. He insists that he was an only child.
Let me ask the other two. Portia, I'll start with you. Do all children have the same history, the same experience of family?
No. In fact, listening to Marjorie talk about having her brother here, that he was an only child, this really brought to home how there were experiences that I had with my brother of his being victimized, and his memory is that I was being victimized, the very same incident. He also has a memory of being abused by my mother, and I have the memory of my mother never spanking us in anger. So the way that each of us look at the same event is so different.
How do you work that out? Do you argue about it? Did you?
My brother died about 5 years ago, colon cancer. It was a wonderful, not his death, but the experience of being there and helping him walk through that experience was incredible, to have closure and all the love that was there. But yet, there were times that we would find ourselves in these horrendous arguments that appeared not to be grounded in the present, but that was grounded in the past. His feeling upstaged by me as a younger sibling was a main problem for him. So some of it we could work out. But then I saw he carried some of his rage over to his children, which broke my heart.
What are the options here? All of you agree as therapists that coming together and talk helps. The research agrees with that. But in order to do this, everyone has to agree that there's a problem, and everyone has to make a commitment. My experience is once that's done, then 90% of the work is done. But how do you get there? How do you get there if your sibling doesn't perceive the same kind of problem that you do or doesn't care as much as you? Marge?
I'm not sure that I agree with you that everyone has to agree that there's a problem or has to have even a remotely similar investment. It's been my experience, both personally and professionally, that sisters and brothers want to help each other. They want to make a difference. An older sibling wants to help a younger sibling heal, solve the problems in their lives, and that siblings will participate in profound therapeutic conversations, even if they don't think there's a problem. Out of goodwill, out of maybe some of those myths and roles that olders and youngers bring to the table and keep with them for their lives. And I think that the activity of being helpful, whether you think there's a problem or not, is in itself transformative for the sibling relationship.
Portia?
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, it's the bond is so strong, mm-hmm. and I think it is so complex that the love, the rage, the joy, the anguish, the competition, all of it's there. And just for one person to acknowledge that there's a problem is enough, as long as your sibling is able to engage in contact with you. And for me, that was what was important. We never saw things alike, but there was a common bond of love, part of which was shared, and part of which with my parents, and part of which was not shared with my parents. And so that was very powerful to realize that we had a relationship that was very separate from our relationships with each of our parents.
Hmm. Bea?
One of the things that I think is really important in addressing adult sibling conflicts that have not been resolved from childhood is for siblings to move from kind of the structure of a triangle, where a lot of the relating is about what happened to them as children and their parents and what their parents did or didn't do, which clearly does have a factual basis, even though perceptions may vary, and then into adulthood, trying to have more of a dyadic relationship with each other, where they can have a relationship not simply based on who they, how they were defined by their parents.
Give us an example.
An example might be where one child was a caregiver in a family, and let's say you have an ill parent, whether it's physically or emotionally ill, and another child was perhaps infantilized by that same parent. So there's going to be on the functional eldest, whether they were the eldest or not, but the caregiver is going to have an experience perhaps of, you know, being tired of giving and feeling like the younger one is using or not appreciating or being babied. And yet as adults, you know, adults can request, hi, let's have a reciprocal relationship now. Let's get out of this kind of time warp. There has to be a shift. Doesn't mean that the other person will change. You can't count on another person to change, but you can free yourself from that bind.
One of the probably most important underpinnings of your work is about fairness and justice,
right,
in families and in the larger world. But in the Ten Commandments of parenting,
right,
commandment number 7 is, thou shalt tell their child life is not fair, over and over and over again.
Yes, I learned that.
I read it, right. I mean, we all
right.
Heard it.
Yeah, life is not fair.
And families are not fair.
Families aren't fair either.
So what do you mean?
Well, families aren't fair. I mean, families love you, and they, you know, they do the best within their limits, I think, to provide care and love. And yet it's up to an individual as they mature and they're able to assess what was fair and not fair to hold parents as well as siblings accountable in a constructive way and to ask for some validation about their experience.
For example,
if I'm going to make this parent and sibling, just so we have a broader view, because a lot of times I think the big problem is that people are more willing to hold hurt and anger vis-a-vis their sibling than they are toward a parent. They'd rather idealize the parent and leave the parent kind of off limits because it's scarier to have anger and hurt with a parent. So an example of that would be, let me go back to the kid who was babied by a parent who basically overheld that child, didn't let them grow up sufficiently. And the older, maybe higher more responsible kid is mad. You know, hey, you got more and you got this and you got that and I didn't. But that's actually misdirected. It was the parent. It's kind of both are responsible. So it has to be addressed to both.
You talked about the concept of a functional elder,
right,
in a family. Does every family have one?
I think that it's more likely when parents are needier, over a chronic period. I don't just mean a short period of time, but when there's some chronicity to a problem or where there's an illness or whether there's an emotional illness, then a sibling is really much more likely to step in.
One of my experiences with functional elders or overly responsible is as they age, by and large, they suffer.
Mm-hmm.
They rail against their roles and they resent it, and they don't give the roles up so easily. They
right.
don't release their grasp. So, Marge, you want to?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking about that keenly because my observation is that often we don't know any other way to perform other than our role. Whether your role is to be the over-functioning elder or the under-functioning younger, it isn't easy to learn to behave newly when you've spent, you know, your life 50 years, 60 years, however many years, being the responsible one and carrying the banner and filling in whenever things have to be taken care of.
My experience is, in addition to the habit, the habitual behavior over the years, these functional elders, overachieving people, grew up experiencing themselves as behaving this way because if they didn't, everything was
yep.
going to fall apart.
Yeah, that's what
and that kind of fear mm-hmm. gets in your bone marrow. And that's my experience.
Yes. And often maybe not even articulatable, that the, you know, that the urgency, the activity precedes reason.
We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on adult sibling relationships today. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Our guests were Drs. B. Janet Hibbs, Portia Hunt, and Marjorie Levitt. Hibbs is the co-director of the Center for Contextual Therapy Associates in Philadelphia. Hunt is professor of counseling at Temple University in Philadelphia, and Levitt is the co-author of Sibling Revelry, 8 Steps to Successful Adult Relationships. We'll hear more from our discussion in just a minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices from the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, school integration, executions, and bong hits for Jesus. We talk about recent issues facing the Supreme Court with Linda Greenhouse, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Welcome back to Voices from the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. As we get older, our relationships with our siblings change, but many times our roles within the family stay the same. On today's show, we're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on adult sibling relationships. Our guests were Drs. B. Janet Hibbs, Portia Hunt, and Marjorie Levitt. Hibbs is the co-director of the Center for Contextual Therapy Associates in Philadelphia. Hunt is professor of counseling at Temple University in Philadelphia, and Levitt is the co-author of Sibling Revelry, 8 Steps to Successful Adult Relationships. Most sibling relationships I know are comfortable,
mm-hmm.
and they are not intimate. And I've heard you use, let me capture the language, harmony over truth.
Right.
First tell us what you mean, and then tell me what's the problem with that. Or
okay.
is there one?
Okay. I think many family members opt for harmony over truth because it feels nicer. It looks nicer. It also may be a family mandate. Get along with your brother. Get along with your sister. Don't make trouble. And truth is messy, and it can put people in conflict. It can create pain initially that people are not prepared for. And also then there are multiple truths. So once you raise your truth, you have to be prepared. This is a little bit like the three blind men trying to describe an elephant, that someone else has an alternate reality, and you have to be willing to entertain their context and how their experience was different and what their truth is. So, you know, truth is very messy. And we all kind of know it's messy, and so we avoid it conveniently when we, you know, don't want to upset the apple cart, so to speak, whether it's with a sibling or whether it's with a parent.
I still wonder what's wrong with a casual and not intimate sibling relationship. Anybody?
I don't think there's anything wrong with that if that's what you want. I mean, in my experience, and I think more as a professional than personally, there's often someone in the family who's wanting more, you know, to have a bigger game, you know, to show more, to have more, to do more. And that creates a problem when one of the siblings is no longer comfortable with an as-if or harmonious holiday kind of relationship.
You ask what's wrong with harmony over truth. And my thought was, because one day, the old gal and the old guy are going to get real old, and somebody's got to take care of them. Someone's going to have to be there to help them make the transition. And when the relationship between the siblings has not healed, then what happens is a sibling ends up either being overburdened with a parent, the parent ends up feeling uncared for, unloved, the ball gets dropped. So the harmony over truth, while it can be safe at the time, it can be devastating when the rubber meets the road, when you really have to make hard decisions about caring for your parents.
Many sibling relationships, many, there's a history of abuse. Some of the meanest behavior I've ever seen happens between siblings, and we know the scars are devastating.
Yes.
What now? My experience is that the perpetrator cares deeply about his or her sib, but kind of minimizes, doesn't see the big thing. How do we get beyond that? How do we get them into the office? Anybody? B?
I think sometimes you don't get them into the office, and I also think that the role of a therapist can be to help coach people to know what do you do with a sibling who really, I would say, where the relationship is limited, and maybe it's going to be limited and remain limited. Because, you know, one of the, you know, Marjorie, you were saying, you know, it's okay if the harmony over truth is what people want. I would say, well, sometimes that's all they're capable of.
Yes.
You know, sometimes having, you know, even just a civil relationship is more than some siblings are capable of. But in terms of how do you heal trauma and abuse and that sort of thing, I think that it is, well, I've seen it be really, you know, facilitated by parents being willing to be involved if they are still living. Because siblings still appeal to parents, even as adults. Hi, did you know Johnny did such and thus to me? Do you believe me? And sometimes that can facilitate siblings' healing by recognizing that the abuser or the bully also is human and not simply an evil monster, and yet that the victim really deserves the acknowledgement and care ongoing from the family in terms of their own experience.
You mentioned Portia as parents' age, and I want to shift to that. What happens as parents' age when we're in a relationship with our sib that gets stuck? What happens to those roles when parents need our help and it inevitably comes up all of a sudden?
Sometimes you have siblings who are stuck in history, who refuse to take on the responsibility of what it means to care for a parent who's going through a transition. And what happens when they get stuck is that it causes the whole family system to destabilize, and the resentment with the caretaker increases. They end up, and oftentimes it's a person who's single, who doesn't have children. Oftentimes it's the one who appears to be at the top of the barrel, so to speak, the one who is unencumbered on the outside. So you find either one sibling becomes stuck in being the baby, or stuck in being the adult and won't allow the other siblings to help. And it can be very powerful in terms of the pain that it regenerates in the family system. You see adult parent siblings fighting over who left you mom's tea set, you know.
Well, yeah, I call that a pain in the assets.
Yes.
I was very careful when I said that.
I got it. It can be very sad, you know, at a time in which you can really help a senior make a transition. And it becomes really, I think, exacerbated if you have a parent who has dementia or Alzheimer's.
The ideal, of course, and we all know that the ideal is planning, talking about it before it happens. But, you know, if there's tension in the relationship, whether it's expressed or unexpressed, you're very unlikely going to sit down and say, let's talk about this, especially including parents. That's just not going to happen. And when the crisis comes, that's not a good time for introspection and personal growth. What happens there?
I think that one of the things that's important that therapists can do is to help the sibling learn how to be in relationship with their sibling, even though the sibling doesn't show up. Because there are times that I've had to coach clients to let the other uninvolved sibling know what they want and what they expect, and not get involved in who shot John or, you know, how we were wounded. To just say, these are the things you have to do.
A friend and colleague of mine used to be at WHYY, Brian Duke, who's an expert on aging. He talks about his relationship with his brother as his mother deteriorated with Alzheimer's, mm-hmm. and he became the responsible one, and he felt resentful. And finally, he had a talk with his brother, and his brother said, what you do, I can't do. Mm-hmm. I can't change diapers and put her in the shower, but here's what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a simple negotiation. So the ideal here would be family planning.
Yes.
Yeah.
Between siblings and family. We know most don't do it. Portia, what would it look like ideally?
My mother would never consider writing a will. And end of life, for her to do something like that, to fill out a document, says that she's going to die. So she's not going to do that. Now, she will talk to me about that and let me know what her wishes are. And when my brother was alive, we would discuss those things between ourselves about how we wanted to care for our, you know, for our parents when they made the transition. And sometimes I think the functional part of the family is the one that's going to have to get together and make some decisions like that.
We're listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion on adult sibling relationships today. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Our guests were Drs. B. Janet Hibbs, Portia Hunt, and Marjorie Levitt. Hibbs is the co-director of the Center for Contextual Therapy Associates in Philadelphia. Hunt is professor of counseling at Temple University in Philadelphia, and Levitt is the co-author of Sibling Revelry, 8 Steps to Successful Adult Relationships. We'll hear more from our discussion in just a minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and you're listening to Voices from the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
Next time on Day to Day, Cindy Mead suffers from severe mental illness.
I used to hide in a corner, and I was afraid of people in general.
Assertive Community Treatment saved her. It's a program that helps with everything from medication to doing laundry.
Without this clinic, I couldn't have become the person I am today, self-sufficient.
One-stop shopping for mental health care, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're listening to excerpts from a panel discussion on adult sibling relationships. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. Our guests were Drs. B. Janet Hibbs, Portia Hunt, and Marjorie Levitt. Hibbs is the co-director of the Center for Contextual Therapy Associates in Philadelphia. Hunt is professor of counseling at Temple University in Philadelphia, and Levitt is the co-author of Sibling Revelry, 8 Steps to Successful Adult Relationships. Let's take questions, comments, reactions.
My mother died 2 months ago, and my brother and I were never really that close. And when I would go up and see my mother, she would say, "Do you want to get together and see Brian?" or something. And that was my brother's name. And I would say, okay, because I think it was something that she wanted. Her brothers didn't talk to each other for years. And so now, I guess the issue that I came for, and you know, I've got a lot to chew on from what you've said, but what kind of energy do I want to put into that relationship now that she's dead?
What's your answer?
I generally have put in most, I feel like I've put in more effort over the years. My initial take was, after she died, I don't have to deal with it. I have to deal with him any longer. But he's the only one left. There were only two of us. And I don't know. I'm thinking about that.
Well, thank you. I'm going to let our guests have a reaction. Thank you for your openness. I really appreciate it. Anybody have a reaction? I'm sure all four of us have a reaction. B, let's start with you.
I have a question for you. Have you ever told your brother that you've done too much of the work to stay connected? Have you ever told him what you needed from him in order to remain connected?
I'd have to say no. No. I've usually listened to him about his difficulty in his divorce, his difficulty with his kids, and then maybe the last minute he'll say, "And how are you?"
Right.
So it's not, I guess I've just never expected him to ask.
Well, you know what? It helps to ask for fairness. Really does. He might not give it, but it'd be hard to keep wanting to relate to him if you don't get something back on your terms.
Tell him about your suffering. You might get a different response. It's more dangerous. You might get a different response. We've got another question.
I'm the youngest of 5, so I'm 42 years old, and yet I remember just recently I was in the hospital visiting a nephew, and my sister, who is, I'm the youngest of 5, and my sister, whose son was in the hospital, felt that for a few moments she had to offer me a directive. Now, I'm a college graduate. My daughter is a third-year student in Tennessee. And yet, while I was just looking at something on the wall, like I think it was a string to pull a code, you know, the code blue. And, you know, naturally I wasn't going to pull it, but I was given the directive to make certain you do not play with that. You know.
Play with that.
So that was one thing. And then I ask you all the question of, what about only children? Because my daughter is an only child. So what do you do about that as well?
I love your sister telling you not to pull the string. That's right. Perfect. I think that, in a nutshell, is the illustration of something irreplaceable, irritating, and lovable about siblings.
I would also suggest, we're talking about relationships, family dynamics, mm-hmm. and macro. Let me just make a micro observation about your sister. To make that statement is a statement about her own anxiety, and that's what she lives with. So that's the mm-hmm. deal mm-hmm. with controllers. It's right. about anxiety that we're trying to manage.
And birth order, too. I don't know a lot about your family, but I wonder if it's been her job for many, 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 many years to see to it that everything works out okay.
So what's the deal with only children?
I think only children fantasize about how wonderful it would be to have siblings. And I think people in a family with siblings often fantasize about how wonderful it would be to be an only child. So I think that the hardest part about being an only child is when you have aging parents. And I think the other, it's like sibling relationships are involuntary. You have them whether you want to have them or not. And you do have a shared history. So there is comfort in having a shared history. And I think that to the extent, what I've sometimes said to only children is go find other people who knew your parents, who loved you when you were a kid, who knew you when you were a kid, people that you might not even realize, were invested in you. Because that is, in a way, the function of this shared history that can be such a wonderful support.
So. There's also a lot of myth-making around only children. And the myth is that they're selfish, self-absorbed, etc. And my experience has been just the opposite. I've seen many only children who were great siblings. They were able to choose siblings, either in cousins or peer relationships, and were very sharing. So I'd like to dispel the myth that only children are spoiled. I don't think it is absolutely true.
Anybody else? Yes.
My father had what might as well have been a stroke about 10 days ago.
I'm sorry.
And I'm going down to the hospital fairly regularly, and it occurs to me that if I go into the room needing something, I can't do nearly as well by him as if I go in there to see what he needs from me. Mm-hmm. And I have a brother and a sister, so I came today to see really what I could learn, what you might say that could help me do what I have to do.
I'm going to steal a page from Marjorie's book. What do you want? What do you need to learn that would be helpful?
Something, the first thing I had intended to say was talking about harmony and truth. And I think that there's some real serious issues between my brother and sister and myself and my father about harmony and truth. I found myself saying to my father the other night when he wanted to go out to eat, Dad, you're in a hospital. You've had brain damage. And he had a really long pause, and I almost felt guilty. And then I decided, no, there's no reason to feel guilty. That's what's happened. And, there's issues about people pretending, and I have a hard time with that.
Could you have both? Could you have what you need and what your father needs?
I think so. I'm not sure that my brother and sister can go along with it, mm-hmm. but I think that what my father and I need to do isn't all that hard.
Mm-hmm. Could you provide leadership for them?
I suppose I'm the recovered black sheep.
Well, you're in a very good position then, aren't you?
Thank you, yes.
Let me ask my guests, I'll turn to you, Bea, why do people pretend?
It's less painful, it postpones grief and mourning. That's the main function really, is that it's a postponement of mourning. And not having to accept all the losses that there are.
So that is always about suffering.
It is about suffering, and avoidance is a good short-term strategy. It's just not a very good long-term strategy.
Have another question?
I have more of a statement. You vindicated only children. In my African-American family, I'm the baby's baby, and I'm an only child. And I did fantasize about having siblings. I had three children, mm-hmm. and I had a girl and two boys. And had to take them to therapy because I couldn't understand what their dynamics were, what their needs were. My daughter, no problem. She's 21 now, no problem. The boys kind of battled each other. And I heard the therapist informed me of the middle child syndrome and the knee baby. And I got all the books and everything for him to, because the baby was fine, the youngest was fine, but that middle child took me through a lot.
We do love our labels,
yes,
don't
yes,
we?
We do.
Because they make us feel more secure, like we know more than we really do.
That's right. They organize reality for
yeah.
us.
So what's this business about middle boys and youngest boys?
I get so tickled by that. My mother had two children, the oldest boy and the oldest girl. And even though my brother is older than I constantly had to remind him that I was the oldest girl. And, God forbid that we would have had another brother. And for me, I think that the labels, while it does help to organize a myth around what's going on, it also lets you know what people expect of you. It helps to manage the competition between siblings, having those birth orders set up there. You can do more than mom would let me do. And that's part of what happens, I think, with the myth around those roles.
I'm just thinking that, the truth of it is that each child is born into a totally different family. And that somehow has an impact, and it can have a significant impact, depending on the family into which that second child or third child or fourth child is born. I see that in people I work with, but also in my own family, that I had my older sister, and my brother had his two older sisters, and that made an enormous difference. When the three of us, in a sense, had a life of our own, and went and did and dragged him and so on and so forth, and inside our little world, it was very different than it was when the whole family, mommy, daddy, grandparents, and so on, were together. I'm not sure how that relates to labels, but it seems sometimes when you look at families, there is the middle child syndrome, that child doesn't feel quite as special, and the baby is the baby, So on the one hand, we eschew labels, but on the other hand, they can be helpful as a kind of shorthand, perhaps.
Yeah, if they're not tattoos.
Yeah.
I also want to suggest something else. I'm listening to this only child raise three children, two of whom are boys, and if I were to write the Ten Commandments of parenting, one of those commandments would be to repeat every day, "I don't know what I'm doing," over and over and over again until you're comfortable with it. I don't know what I'm doing, mm-hmm. and that opens the door to learn who they are.
Yes.
Another question?
You're talking earlier about whether it's more important to have harmony or truth. And I think it's in the importance of siblings, of having healthy relationships, is that if you're not able to have a healthy relationship with this person that you have no choice, but they are some of the most intimate people in your life, then how able are you to have real relationships with others?
That is a critical issue that rarely gets talked about in any circles. We talk about with marriages and intimate relationships, we look at relationships with our parents, but siblings can have as influential, if not more influential, a role.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good kind of circling back around, that it makes sense to work through whatever you've got to work through with your siblings, because they are your original peer group. They are the, that's the template. That's how we learn to be how we're going to be. So whether you have a sibling who's willing or not, it seems that there's a tremendous valence in working through that and developing that relationship.
We also are making the assumption that we're talking about a nuclear family. And one of the things that I see happening over and over again is that when we have groups of children, sometimes, and when Marjorie said each one is being born into a new family, sometimes there are secrets around the birth of children. Mm-hmm. And those secrets play out throughout the life of the sibling relationships. But you're right. The sibling relationship does set the template oftentimes for how we choose to relate to our partners, or how we are trapped in how we relate to our partners.
You just reminded me of a very painful piece of my history. My second child was unplanned for. She was born 11 months after her older sister, so she didn't have trouble figuring that out. But one of the things that happened to me, I don't even know if it happened to her mother, was when she was born, I had such tremendous anxiety about her being neglected that this first child was, you know, the first child,
yes.
You know. And I had tremendous anxiety about this child being neglected. And that informed my parenting for the first several years of her birth. And these things need to be talked about.
Yes,
right. And another question.
Well, because of my family dynamic, I had a sister who was 6 years older. I decided a very long time ago that I would have either zero or one child. And I did end up having one child who's now 36. And I remember talking to her about siblings, and she said, well, Mom, you know, she was quite young. She said, well, you know, I really would like to have a baby brother or sister. She said, on the other hand, the resources are limited, and this way I get it all. my issue is really with my sister, who's the older one, and she has taken on this role of telling everybody in the family what to do. And I have finally realized at my advanced age that it is about her anxiety to have everything look wonderful. However, when we're in family situations, the only way that she communicates with people is by giving them orders or criticizing or making suggestions. And everybody in the family knows that. And it's very uncomfortable because it also says, well, this person is so shallow, she's been unable to develop any kind of relationship with any of us. And I dislike that. I'm very affected by that. That dynamic affects me, and I have good relationships with the other people. And we've talked about it, but it's like you just don't come up against this person. Maybe people realize that she's just not too deep.
I don't recall which family therapist said, referring to the phrase, when we get together with our parents and siblings, the language we use is we're going back home, that
right.
It's always regressive, and mm-hmm. somebody said, on average, we lose 10 years
yes.
off of our emotional
life. My little baby came home.
Emotional
mm-hmm.
life.
Right. Okay, so it seems like you have a couple of choices, and that would be to alert your sister to what she's doing, and let her know what you truly, how you'd really hope it could go differently.
Well, that's what I've thought of doing, and I wonder, she's 75 and I'm 69, and I wonder, is it really fair to ask her to do that?
Favorite line that people say, usually it's about their parents, they're too old, you know, to talk to, and usually the range of age is like 50 to 85. So I think, unless your sister's like really debilitated and sick and that sort of thing, in which it would be dumping on her, if you don't dump on somebody, it's fair.
The question I ask often with anybody of any age is, what's it like? What's it like for, I'd ask her, what's it like for you when you're in a family gathering? What's it like inside? And I would ask that of you. You told us that she's very anxious and is quite controlling. you behave in a habitual way. You react in a predictable way. They're two facts, and they don't have to be connected. One you have more control over than the other. One is about her anxiety. I don't know what yours is about. It's worth taking a look at. Just a thought. We have time for one more question. Comment?
Hi, this has been a wonderful experience just listening to how family dynamics create who you are. And I was listening to what you were saying about the birth order, and it's four of us, two sisters, like in their late 50s, early 60s, and then two sisters that are in their 40s. I'm in the second category. And we kind of flip-flop, really, with, you know, this time I'm going to be in charge and I'm going to take over and I want to be the baby now. Is that an unusual dynamic? You know, because the birth order thing is really kind of throwing me.
I think it's wonderful.
I do too. I was going to say, look at you.
Oh, okay.
That's what we all are, whether we acknowledge it or not. Sometimes we're babies and sometimes we're needy and sometimes we're responsible and sometimes we're anxious and sometimes we're terribly annoying. And that's who we are. And if we can find ourselves in a world, a relationship, a family that can tolerate that, how blessed we are. I want to thank my guests for coming out tonight, for your wisdom, for your mm-hmm. wonderful contributions. And I want to thank you all for joining us. Thank you. You've been listening to excerpts from a recent panel discussion about adult sibling relationships. It was part of our In the Spirit of Family series presented by WHYY's Children's Service. My guests were Drs. Janet Hibbs, Portia Hunt, and Marjorie Levitt. Hibbs is the co-director of the Center for Contextual Therapy Associates in Philadelphia. Hunt is a professor of counseling at Temple University, and Levitt is the co-author of Sibling Revelry, 8 Steps to Successful Adult Relationships. Well, if you've got a question, comment, you can email us at voices@whyy.org. You can listen to archive editions of Voices in the Family at our website, whyy.org/voices, and you can download shows there. Thank you to Susan Palinko and Jennifer Wheeler from WHYY's Children's Service. The engineers for today's show have been John Knapp and Al Banks. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Our intern is Shane Ewing, and Lisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
Day-to-day.